If you live in Wisconsin, sooner or later you'll encounter this phrase, the Wisconsin idea. But what does it mean, or what could it mean to you? I'm Ann Strainchamps with a special edition of To the Best of Our Knowledge, recorded a couple of weeks ago on stage in front of an audience at the University of Wisconsin. Our theme, the Wisconsin idea.
When I first moved to Wisconsin and started working at Wisconsin Public Radio, I kept hearing about this thing called the Wisconsin idea. I didn't know what it was, but it sounded totally cool. Because I remember thinking, you know, Illinois, Minnesota, Michigan, they've got their state birds, their state crops, their state flags. We've got an idea. However, it's really hard to put an idea on a license plate. So especially a really big idea. And the Wisconsin idea turns out to be huge. You know, it's a philosophy. It's a vision for public enlightenment. And the description that I really like, this is what Adlai Stevenson said. The Wisconsin tradition meant more than a simple belief in the people. It also meant a faith in the application of intelligence and reason to the problems of society. It meant a deep conviction that the role of government was not to stumble along like a drunkard in the dark, but to light its way by the best torches of knowledge and understanding it could find. So basically, how I interpret that is we live in a state that has historically valued seeking truth and sharing wisdom so greatly that it's a core mission. Now, as we know lately, there are people who find the Wisconsin idea elitist. There are people who would like to challenge it. There are people who feel excluded from it and by it. And that's the thing about big ideas and big dreams. They have to be constantly, in every generation, reinterpreted, reimagined. So each of our guests tonight embodies some aspect of the Wisconsin idea. They are each people who, in their own ways, in their own professions, are pushing the Wisconsin idea forward into the future. So let's welcome, first of all, our executive producer, Steve Paulson, who is also, by the way, my husband, which means that he not only produces great radio, he also walks my dog and does my laundry. Sorry, honey. Also, UW-Madison's Kathy Kramer. She is a political scientist, director of the Morgridge Center for Public Service, and author of a new pathbreaking work on politics, power, and rural identity. It's called The Politics of Resentment.
Now, if the core principle of the Wisconsin idea is that the boundaries of the university are the boundaries of the state, then Kathy Kramer is a perfect example of how to put this idea into practice. Kathy's research for the last decade has taken her to the far corners of the state, where she's been talking with, as she puts it, ordinary people, not politicians or academics or experts. And her new book, The Politics of Resentment, is not just a fascinating portrait of what she calls rural consciousness in Wisconsin, it's also a new lens for how we can understand the deep political divide in our state. And I have to say, as a longtime resident of Madison and a public employee, it's a sobering portrait of what people in small towns and rural areas think about people like me. Because we're often seen as privileged, elitist, and the beneficiaries of taxpayer money. So I think it's fair to say that all of us in Wisconsin have a lot to learn about each other. Kathy, it is great to have you here.
Thank you. It's really my honor.
When you started meeting with these people, and I know you met with lots of different groups around the state, were you surprised by what they said?
Oh, absolutely. I grew up in the state, just north of Milwaukee, and thought I knew the state very well and designed a study that would get me out and about around the state because I loved the state. I wasn't looking for divides in the state. I wasn't even aware of a rural versus urban divide. And it very much surprised me, the level of resentment that I heard in some of the smaller communities in the state towards Madison and Milwaukee and public employees.
And the university.
And the university.
I mean, UW professors are not that well-liked in some parts of the state, right?
That is true. So, yes, you have to understand that I was walking into, say, gas stations early in the morning and saying, "Hi, I'm Kathy from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Do you mind if I join you this morning?" And they would laugh a little bit and then invite me in. And I would give them a card, you know, a business card saying it was very clear, I'm a professor in the political science department at UW-Madison. And in general, they were very kind to me, but they also made it very clear when I got around to asking about their ideas about the university that faculty, including you, Kathy, are, you know, kind of lazy. You're never in the classroom. You have your summers off. Liberal, probably you as a political scientist, you're probably on the left end of the spectrum, and you're kind of elitist in the sense, you know, you have healthcare insurance, don't you, Kathy? And you have a pension, right? And you probably make a pretty good salary, and you have really little idea about what small town life is like.
So they just said that to you, just straight to your face.
Yeah, that's a paraphrase, but it came in many different, yeah, you know. It came in many different versions. I mean, imagine, I'm laughing, and I truly want to convey that these conversations were delightful. So at the same time, they were delivering some pretty hard news to me that was very sobering, as you say. They were also very nice about it, but they would say things like, okay, so you're a professor at the university, and you're here 5 hours away from the university, and how does this work that you're driving around the state having coffee with people like us? Aren't you supposed to be teaching?
Aren't you supposed to be working?
Yeah, right. I'd say, well, I'm on a sabbatical year, and then trying to explain what a sabbatical was like. You know, I mean, you can imagine the people were critical.
So what did you say when people said that to you?
Well, I learned pretty quickly that it wasn't my place to say, no, seriously, I do work hard. I work really hard. That, you know, that just reinforced this perception that there, you know, there goes another Madison person acting as though he or she knows what the real deal is, and our point of view isn't valid. So I just listened. I mean, I tried to take it in and convey that it was important to me to understand where they were coming from. And to not necessarily discredit myself or the work that I was doing, but to not make it my place to say, no, you're wrong. This is what is reality. But instead to acknowledge that they have perceptions, and it was important for me that I take the time to listen to them.
Did you have to do some soul searching in this whole process as you were meeting
for sure.
These people? What was hardest for you?
The resentment towards public employees was hard to hear. This perception, just becoming aware that there were so many people who I came across relatively randomly who felt as though they were not being listened to by any institution, any set of elites. So the university is partly in there, but also the government, the healthcare industry, corporations. I mean, there was just this very pervasive sense of loss that came through in these conversations, and a sense that something was seriously off with our state.
So was the criticism, was the resentment that we public employees, and you know, we're both part of that system. We're both public employees that we're getting more than our fair share. We're getting paid too much? Was that a piece of this?
Absolutely. So there were, the resentment that I talk about was partly about who's getting public dollars, federal, state, county, whatever level of government, and that some people are getting more than their fair share. It's also about who has power in the state, who's getting listened to, and then also just who has respect. So it was all of those different things together. And in terms of public employees, one of the things that I think was hardest for me to hear was this notion of who works hard in a population, in our population, and therefore who is deserving. So the notions of who's getting their fair share and or more than their fair share and who isn't were very intertwined with these notions of who is working hard.
How was that defined? I mean, hard work. I mean, why was the assumption that people in Madison, public employees, don't work hard?
A lot of it had to do with manual labor in most of the conversations I was taking part in. So to put it bluntly, I mean, sometimes people would say to me, so, okay, when do you take a shower, Kathy? And I'd say, I mean, you have to understand many of these groups were predominantly men. And so the question like that made me wonder at times where the conversation was going. But I would say, you know, before I go to work. And then they would say, well, see, we work so hard during the day that the first thing we have to do when we come home is take a shower. And so in their mind, how could it be that if I'm sitting behind a desk all day, or if public employees are sitting behind a desk all day, that that's hard work? So a lot of times it was defined in that way. But to be honest, a lot of these conversations about who works hard and who's deserving were very intertwined with race and the sense of, you know, the long time stereotypes of which groups of people in the population are lazy or which groups are hard workers. And that was in the conversation too.
What did you say to that? I mean, did you respond at all?
At times. I mean, yeah, how do I describe this? So, yeah, imagine that I'm there with the purpose of listening and acknowledging perspectives and trying not to correct them, and then hearing at times some disturbing perceptions. Usually what happened is just as I was about to step in and say something, someone else in the group would offer a slightly different perspective, and then I was able to build on that some. But you know, stereotypes of laziness are pervasive, and I can't say that I was ever successful in any given conversation of correcting or changing someone's point of view.
You said respect was an issue as well. I mean, that a lot of these people outstate, and again, we're talking about people in small towns, in rural areas, that they feel like they're not being listened to, and they're not being heard. But what, I'm guessing the respect goes beyond that. I mean, how they felt disrespected.
Yeah, so it's partly about whether or not they felt listened to, but also whether or not they felt as though their values and their concerns and their lifestyles were taken into account when important decisions in the state or the nation were being made. So there, you know, I had many conversations about different policies that to certain people in certain communities seemed as though they were designed for people in urban settings and were made in a way that was pretty clueless about rural life. So, for example, I remember one municipality, people were talking with me about these regulations that were supposed to fill out all this paperwork with respect to gutters. Well, we don't actually have gutters in this town because we don't have sidewalks, and we don't really even, you know, we have roads, but some of them are gravel and such. So conversations like that, people felt like, see, like, we're just not even on folks' radar.
Well, now, you were saying that there was a lot of resentment about public employees and, you know, getting too much from the government. What about their local schools? What do they think about them?
It's a complex issue. For sure. So on the one hand, I found many people across these different groups very much valuing education and oftentimes would be talking about their school consolidation, for example, as a real threat to their identity in the community, in the sense that, you know, when our schools go, what's left in this community? That's kind of the end of the community. But at the same time, telling me things like, we're not opposed to spending on education in general, but, you know, if our taxes go up for education, that money is going to go to Madison and Milwaukee, not to here. So at the same time people valued education, they were reluctant to believe claims that higher taxes would mean improvements in their own local education.
So you've been laying out the problem here. I mean, there's this huge political divide. I mean, we haven't really gotten into the politics of this, but cultural divide. What can we do? But, I mean, is there a way to bring people together when, I mean, to some degree, you're talking about living in almost different countries?
Yeah. Well, my experience of having my eyes opened so much, I mean, I consider myself a lifelong Wisconsinite. I thought of myself as a small town Wisconsin person. I learned pretty quickly that my hometown, 7,000 people, now 9,000 or 10,000, is not small town Wisconsin, right? That there is so much to be gained from listening to one another. So in our everyday lives, it may be that the rural versus urban divide is difficult to bridge because it is a geographic one, and those of us who, say, live in the Madison metro area don't have a lot of experience who are living with people who are living in other parts of the state. And yet we do, right? Some of us travel and we go elsewhere in the state. I think it's worthwhile to go to places not as a tourist, but as someone who truly wants to learn.
So how do you do that? I mean, it's one thing to say we need to talk to each other. Any suggestions of how?
If I can do it, anybody can do it. I really think, I mean, I'm a very shy person, and
I mean just walking into the local gas station, to the local diner where people gather.
Yes, I actually do. I actually think when you're in a grocery store in another community, gas stations are easier, honestly, because everybody in town sort of knows that at a certain time of day, that's where this gas station is where people are gathering. To walk in and say, I'm so-and-so from such-and-such. Do you mind if I join you this morning? You don't have to be a professor to do that. People, yes, will think you're nuts initially. But within seconds, people, if you can convey the sincerity in that, then I'm not doing this for a game. No one's put me up to a bet. And I'm not here to sell you something or tell you something. But that you actually want to learn from them. People love to tell you about themselves. How often are we asking each other in our daily lives, I want to know what's on your mind. I want to know what you think. And when you're asked that, it's a really wonderful experience. So I don't know if you're going to ask me another question that will allow me to make this plug, but I was not primed to do this, but public radio, right? I mean, really... I sincerely mean that I think it is one of these great public institutions that enables us to listen to one another if we can't travel or we do think that I'm actually nuts and I'm not going to go and walk in randomly to some gas station and introduce myself, right? But public radio is an opportunity for us to listen to one another.
Well, thank you for the plug, and thank
you
for joining us.
You're
what
welcome.
A pleasure.
It's my honor. My honor. Thank you. Thank you. Sure.
That's Steve Paulson talking with Kathy Kramer. Kathy's a political scientist and the director of the Morgridge Center for Public Service at the University of Wisconsin, and she's the author of The Politics of Resentment.